You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18+. Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello everyone and welcome to History of the Second World War. On this episode of our Spanish Civil War interview series, I was joined by Dr. Matthew Carey, the author of Unite, Proletarian Brothers, Radicalism and Republicanism in the Second Spanish Republic, which was released earlier this year. Our discussion focused on the events in Asturias, a region in Spain, in 1934. During October 1934, there would be a national strike throughout Spain, and in most areas, this strike would either quickly burn out or would be broken up by the government. However, in Asturias, the strike would morph into a true revolution, and for 2 weeks, Asturias would be under the control of revolutionary committees. In the end, 1,700 people would be killed in the region, and 260 members of the Spanish military would be included in that number. One of the topics that we touch on near the end of this interview, and which I think is really important, is the role that Asturias would play in Franco's narrative of imminent and very possible revolution during and after the events of the Civil War. And then I bumped my microphone. Okay. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Spanish Civil War interview series. Today, I'm here with Dr. Matthew Carey, the author of Unite, Proletarian Brothers, Radicalism and Republicanism in the Second Spanish Republic. Dr. Carey, how's it going today?
It's not too bad, to be honest. It could be a lot worse in the circumstances.
Indeed.
Very happy to be here.
2020 has been a year, is all I will say.
Definitely.
Okay, so when I think about socialist revolutionary activity, and I think this is probably pretty common among the people listening to this, I think of urban centers, St. Petersburg, Berlin, Vienna, Paris. But Asturias, where this Asturias revolution takes place, is a region full of coal fields and related economic activity, which doesn't seem very urban to me. So what was this area like in terms of population and density and stuff like that?
Well, it's an area, so Asturias is a region which it's varied, it's very mountainous, it's coastal, there is agriculture, and then, as you say, there's this kind of coal mining area to the south of the capital. And this is an area that, although compared to somewhere like the Ruhr in Germany, is quite ruralized, it is nonetheless quite heavily urbanized within its wider context. So we're talking about several steep-sided, kind of winding valleys in which roughly about 150,000 people live. And they live in quite different circumstances depending on the particular area. So lower down the valleys, you have larger, denser settlements with more industry, steel industry, coal, so shafts into the coal pits themselves. But then as you go further up the valleys, you get more agricultural activity, more mountain mines, so mines dug into the side of mountains themselves, and the population here can be quite widely dispersed. So you have quite sometimes thousands living in the capital of a particular district, and then lots of people who are living in quite small hamlets and villages that are kind of more dotted around kind of the hillsides and further up into the mountains. And in terms of Oviedo itself, so the capital of the region, this is seen and traditionally is very much kind of the bourgeois city of services, of banking, and around 75,000 people lived in the kind of the municipal district of Oviedo itself. But in the capital, it's only about half of that population. The rest live in rural areas, but also kind of industrial towns that are kind of near the capital, producing arms, explosives, and things like cement. So I suppose that Asturias as a region, the coal fields themselves are quite distinctive to an extent. They're quite typical, I suppose, of the north of Spain, but quite different to areas of the south. We're talking about an area that's, in terms of its population, is very different to Madrid and Barcelona and somewhere like Bilbao, of course, with its iron mines, but also quite different to the south of Spain, where you have the agro towns, these kind of very large towns full of agricultural workers. It definitely, in that sense, is much more rural than other areas of Europe.
Excellent. And so this area has a kind of a mix of leftist ideological beliefs, much like every other place in Spain at this period. Could you discuss sort of what the mix was in terms of those beliefs in this area and how they kind of coexisted at this time?
Yes, certainly. So that in terms of the left itself, and it's important to note as well that there's also a strong strand of republicanism as well, which we generally identify more with the centre. But in terms of the left, we have communists, anarchists and socialists. So all three exist in this particular area. And they're organised in 1931 into two unions in terms of the coal fields, in terms of the mine workers themselves. And numerically and institutionally, it's the socialists who are the strongest. They have the largest mining union, although it undergoes an important crisis in the 1920s during the Primo de Rivera dictatorship. And it's strong institutionally because it has a large network of political and cultural centres, lots of associations. It has its own schools for children, lending libraries, cooperatives, and a long, et cetera. And the socialists and their membership is recovering in 1931, and they take advantage really of the prestige of being involved in the kind of the proclamation of the Second Republic, and therefore they attract many supporters. Many of those who, of course, deserted them in the 1920s. So then we have the anarchists and the communists, and numerically the anarchists are. There are more anarchists than there are communists in the coalfields, and they both traditionally are identified with particular localities. So the anarchists tend to be identified with somewhere like La Felguera, which was a steel town, and it was a particular area of anarchist strength. And the communists are often identified with Turon, which is this particular valley in which that one particular mining company operated. But actually, I think if you dig a bit deeper, then these different groups exist. These ideologies exist all over the place in smaller pockets. And so I mentioned the fact that there were two unions. So there is the Socialist Union, and then there is the SUM Union, as it's called, the kind of Single Mine Workers Union. This is led by communists, but the rank and file are anarchists, which is not really a very stable combination, though. Communist emphasis on hierarchy and the anarchist kind of free thinking and kind of direct action strategies. And this comes to a head in 1931. So there's a strike just after the Republic's proclaimed, and it's a real kind of battle between the socialist mining union and this kind of anarchist communist mining union. It's a bit of a stalemate. The anarchist communist union declares it, but doesn't really win. And actually that union ends up splitting by the end of the year because of the tensions inherent within it. And so there's often been an emphasis from historians about this period, about this place, of the emphasis on a rival between these different unions, that socialists and anarchists and communists didn't get on, which is a story that we might be very kind of familiar with. But I think, I mean, what I've tried to emphasise in my work and what I've seen is there's actually quite a lot of workplace cooperation at times. It's not always easy, and there's a lot of resentment, but there are shared practices like assemblies at the pits when there's a strike, and then there'll be votes. There are debates, often quite fractious debates between these different groups. But this collaboration is often at the grassroots, and the union leaderships, particularly the socialist union leadership, does not like the rank and file working with the other group. And the other thing I suppose that's important to mention is the Workers' Alliance, which is emblematic of the revolution of 1934. And it's an agreement signed in late March 1934. And it's seen as the moment in which the anarchists and the socialists put their differences aside and work together, organize the revolution. And you know, this is profoundly important for kind of the rest of the history of the left through the Civil War itself, this cooperation between the two. My view of the Workers' Alliance is more complicated. I don't think it was quite as easy as that. There are a lot of anarchists in the coalfields, for example, who don't actually like this alliance. And it was only narrowly ratified by the anarchist organization in September 1934. And so I think if you look beyond the leadership and the agreements the leaderships are signing, things are both kind of are much more complicated in practice, both more collaboration, but also more friction.
You mentioned that there was a socialist, communist, and anarchist presence within these various unions. What was the general relationship between the size of these groups within the larger union structure?
The trade union density is really high in this area during the Second Republic. And when it comes to the figures for the mine workers themselves, the vast majority do belong to a union. What is quite interesting, I suppose, in 1933, there is a bit of a shift. So there's been a battle between these different unions to try and capture as many mine workers as possible and to capture members from different unions. 1933, there are these kind of grassroots committees, strike committees, in which mine workers would elect, as well as a socialist delegate, an anarchist delegate, and a communist delegate, they elect a delegate for the unaffiliated as well. There's a recognition that there are a small, and it is a small minority, who do not belong to the socialist, anarchist, or communist ranks, and that they should also have a voice in these committees, which is quite striking, particularly when the socialists are so overwhelmingly powerful institutionally. They have the vast majority of the mine workers are signed up to the socialist mining union.
Interesting. So in the years before the Spanish Civil War, you know, from the founding of the Republic in 31 and forward, is a kind of a turbulent political period for Spain. And I know that in 1933, the Spanish elections saw a more traditional conservative government elected. 1933, for most people know, is also kind of a turbulent year in other countries, perhaps in Germany. Was there anything about the events that were happening elsewhere in the world that fueled concerns in Spain, especially among, you know, the people we're talking about right now on the Spanish left, about how they hope to prevent sort of the repression that they saw in other countries at this time?
Yeah, yes and no, I think. I think it's difficult, and we can look at this at different levels. I think when we look at the kind of the national level and the national, or the socialist movement on a national level, I shouldn't say national socialist movement, because in this particular issue it comes even more... becomes even more complicated. But in terms of the socialist movement, there is a particular figure, Francisco Largo Caballero, hugely important minister of labor at the beginning of the Republic. And he becomes kind of the leader of both the party and the socialist trade union between 33 and 34. And he's the one who is kind of the brains, supposedly, behind the 1934 revolution. And there's a socialist who's a particular influence on him. Who is, in fact, the ambassador to Germany through 1932 and 33. So he sees kind of the crisis of the kind of the end of the Weimar regime, and he feeds through his writings and through his reports into the socialist movement what is going on in Germany. So there is certainly an awareness of what's going on in Germany. Now, if you look at the level of what's happening in Asturias, what I've tracked is the emergence, really, of the word fascist in the press, in the socialist press in Asturias. That really only happens after Hitler becomes chancellor in early 1933. So there is kind of, you know, there is an awareness of fascism. There's not really an understanding of what fascism really is, particularly how fascism would work in Spain, given its kind of Catholic traditions or a particular Catholic part to the political culture, and given the way that the majority party on the right was very Catholic, it wasn't exactly clear how fascism would work in Spain. And it's not clear really whether fascism is just a way of repressing the left or whether it is a more generative political project in its own right. And I think that, there is really a lack of understanding of what's going on. And it's easy to just dismiss fascism as in the Marxist way as it was at the time, as simply kind of another crisis or the final crisis of capitalism itself. And so through 1933, there's both a kind of a lack of understanding, but also kind of also a dismissal of it, that there doesn't really seem to be fascism in a Spanish context, which is true in the sense that the Spanish fascist party as we know it, the Falange, was only founded at the end of 1933. And so there is, I don't really see much of a learning of what, of lessons from Germany, so to speak, in 1933 itself. 1934, in the wake of the elections, and with the change in government, there's greater fear, there's a much sharper edge to kind of to the political struggles in 1934. The socialists seem particularly impacted by what happens in Austria, so the crushing of the Austrian socialist movement. And I think it's not lost on them that Dollfuss, as a Catholic authoritarian leader, is perhaps closer to what they would see in Spain. And it also, I think, is not lost on them as well that compared to Hitler, who was installed in power and kind of things changed from one day to another, Dollfuss, what you see with Dollfuss, in the words of Tim Kirk, is this salami slicing of the socialist movement and of kind of and the erosion of democracy. And therefore, I think there is this fear of a gradual slide into authoritarianism and potentially fascism in the future. And so the remedy for all of this that's talked about and is shouted about in the press is some kind of working class unity. But I don't really see a kind of a real strong kind of analysis of what's gone on in Germany and what the problem is at this moment in time. And there seems to be kind of this fleeing, there's a phrase in Spanish of kind of fleeing forwards towards this planning of the insurrection, that this seems to be the solution. You know, attack is the best form of defense to an extent. And that, I suppose, is where the revolution of 1934 can be positioned.
Okay. And speaking of that 1934 revolution, there was a general strike or a call for a general strike in late 1934. And these strikes would occur in many areas of Spain, it seems like, and there would be some violence. But it was only in Asturias that it ended up being a sustained revolution. How did it only happen in one place? Like, what happened elsewhere to where they sort of backed out or whatever happened in those areas? And was it simply the fact that those others didn't necessarily fail? It just so happened to only work in Asturias.
It's a very interesting question, and I'm not sure really that anyone has really answered this adequately to my mind. And I also include myself in that. I think one of the questions that was driving my research, and one of the things that I tried to answer was the energy behind the revolt in Asturias and why thousands of men in particular, a few women, but mainly men, you know, took up arms against the government, and try and understand exactly how you get that switch and that ability to turn on the government. I've provided my answer to that in terms of radicalism and radicalization in my work, but that doesn't really answer why in Asturias the revolt was relatively successful, as in it lasted for 2 weeks, whereas everywhere else it didn't last quite as long. I think there's something distinctive about Asturias, and then there are kind of, and these relate to the factors in other areas as well. So I think I think when it comes to Asturias itself and its relative success, I think firstly, there is a relative strength of organization and a force of numbers. And this relates both to, well, so there's a relative strength of numbers and also the weakness of the security services and the army itself. So you have thousands of men who are members of trade unions, who've been, some of them in terms of socialists, have been in training, a bit ad hoc, but some kind of training, and also the stockpiling of arms ahead of this insurrection. So they are to an extent prepared, and they are used to kind of, to being organized in the trade union itself. And so you have an area in which there are thousands, you know, there is this particular trade union density, they are, you have force of numbers. You have small outposts of the police, of the security forces, and of the army itself. So they were overwhelmed relatively quickly. And when it comes to Oviedo itself, the capital, and this is the scene of most of the fighting during the insurrection, this isn't a massive outpost for the army, for example. So I think in that respect, that is one of the first factors that I think is quite important for why it's relatively successful. Secondly, they're relatively well equipped in that they do have some arms. They run out quite quickly, but they do have arms, and they have dynamite. The miners have dynamite, and this is, it becomes a useful weapon of war. Geography, I think, is the third factor which is important. We're talking about kind of narrow mining valleys that they managed to gain hold of very quickly. But it also is quite difficult to move from León, which is to the south, and the beginning of the Meseta, so the central plains of Spain. And there's a column of an army column that tries to kind of invade Asturias and quickly becomes bogged down in fighting with the miners, because the miners are quite adept at holding this particularly, this mountainous country. And it means as well that troops have to be sent by sea all the way around the coast. So it takes a while for reinforcements to arrive. So I think those particular factors are important. And so in Madrid, for example, where you have a strike that lasts a fair few days, it's much more difficult to gain hold of Madrid as a group of militias. There is not the strength in numbers at the same time in terms of the amount of workers. The CNT, the anarchists don't agree with the strike. They don't sign up to it. There seems to be a lack of leadership in Madrid as well. And there's also many more army garrisons. So it's much more difficult to gain military hold of the capital. When it comes to somewhere like Andalusia in the south, the story that's usually told, and I think is pretty convincing, is that there was an important agricultural strike in June 1934, so only 3-4 months earlier. And what this means is that, and this was crushed, so the socialist organizations, which had been powerful, were both exhausted, disarticulated, some people had been arrested. It was very difficult to organize and to prepare for some sort of vaguely defined revolutionary movement. The Basque Country, I think it's no coincidence, this is the area where you see kind of the strongest reaction along with Asturias itself, particularly around Bilbao. And these, again, are kind of a very dense industrial area that haven't been exhausted by an agricultural strike in the same way that South has. And so here, and there are also arms factories dotted around Eibar and the like. So there you have arms, you have a proletariat who is willing to use them, and therefore, you know, that is why there is a more sustained revolt there as well. Events in Catalonia, I think, are quite different. So in the midst of the crisis, at the beginning of these kind of strikes and insurrections on the 6th, from the 5th to the 6th of October 1934, Lluís Companys, the president of the Catalan region, declares a Catalan state within a federal republic. So I think there are factors at play in Catalonia which are quite different to the rest of to the socialist uprising in kind of the rest of Spain. Companys is taking advantage of this crisis. He is a Catalan nationalist, And there is a long-running matter in Catalonia around a particular form of agrarian reform, which has caused a government crisis over the summer. So there is kind of friction and resentment between the Catalan nationalists in Madrid, and I think this is what leads to a very short-lived, it barely lasts 12 hours, this Catalan Republic within a federal state.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Interesting. So you mentioned that in Asturias, this kind of continues for a couple of weeks. And so how was the revolution controlled during those 2 weeks? Were there revolutionary committees? How were they organized and coordinated?
Yeah, so there are a number of revolutionary committees. There is what is called, and it styles itself as the provincial revolutionary committees, and then a series of kind of local level committees themselves. And the provincial level committees seem to be very much in control of the insurrection, and it's identified with particularly prominent figures like Belomino Tomás, who. Is the man who the socialist, and he's a prominent socialist from the coalfields, who negotiates the kind of the surrender of the forces at the end of the insurrection. Ramon González Peña is seen as the generalissimo of the insurrection itself, and he's also a member. I am not convinced that this committee was in control of what was going on always in the insurrection itself. I think it's an important figurehead. It is. For the first few days, positioned in Oviedo, which is the front, basically. This is the streets of the capital where the militias are fighting against the government forces. They're certainly issuing a lot of kind of decrees and trying to find out what is going on in the local level committees, but I'm not convinced they have a strong control over it. That said, I don't see in the accounts and in the documents any real sense of a huge amount of lawlessness. I think the committees do take power quite quickly, and they have a clear monopoly on power, which I think is quite important for the level of violence in the insurrection itself. So if we go down to the local level committees, these, compared to, say, at the end of the First World War, when we have the kind of council communism, the committees in Asturias here in 1934 are not, for example, based at the factory or the mine. They're based very much at the level of the locality. So we have them springing up in villages and towns, and the ones in the larger towns have a certain amount of prestige and exert a certain amount of control over smaller, more local committees as well. And these are formed, so although the insurrection is led by the socialists or sparked by the socialists, these committees tend to have a real variety of members of left-wing organizations, of socialists, anarchists and communists, and even dissident communists as well. And it seems that there really was a commitment or an attempt to recognize that although, for example, in Mieres, the number of dissident communists was really a handful or a couple of handfuls, at most. They deserved a delegate, that although the socialists outnumbered them by many, many, many to one, it made sense to actually give everybody a voice in a certain democratic manner. So we have those local level committees, and then we have the provincial level committees as well. And then it's important also to differentiate between three different periods. So for the first 6 days, there is a first wave of committees that establish themselves, proclaim the revolution. Once it becomes clear that the revolutionaries are actually on the back foot and that they don't have support in the rest of Spain, there is a wobble, there is a crisis. And in fact, the provincial committee decrees kind of a retreat, but the militias keep fighting, which may be a question of lack of communication. And some of the local committees do dissolve themselves, do disappear, including the provincial committee itself, and they are replaced by a kind of more radical wave of committees of younger socialists and communists. But this only lasts for a day before it's replaced by a kind of a more moderate final phase. And this is the one led by Belarmino Tomás. And he is the one who eventually kind of organizes a kind of surrender with the army itself.
So mostly during the first, like the first 6 days, that first committee, what was their goal? From reading your book, it seems pretty ambiguous, perhaps a bit unrealistic, which, you know, happens a lot with these revolutionary movements. So what were they hoping to achieve in those first 6 days when they thought something was possible?
I suppose my way of looking at the revolution itself is very much as a contradictory and multifaceted phenomenon. And so I think there's often been a tendency amongst historians to try and pin a kind of a single word onto what the revolution was and what it wanted to achieve. And I suppose I tried to do that to begin with and then realized in some respects it was quite a futile exercise. And I think if you go back to the fact that this is a socialist organized movement, and the plans were set for a kind of revolutionary movement that was very hazily defined over the previous months. In his memoirs, Largo Caballero, the organizer, details some of the instructions that were given out to the given to local socialist organizations, which talk about, you know, seizing bridges and seizing telecommunications and ensuring control locally. But it's not really clear in that what he actually wanted. And I suppose my interpretation of what he wanted from a national level was for this movement to be subordinate, I think, to national level political concerns. And so the insurrection or the movement is sparked by the arrival of the Theda, so this large Catholic right-wing political party. It's ascent to power, it enters government for the first time, which is interpreted as a threat to the Republic. And so I think what Largo Caballero wants to see is a show of strength by socialists, some kind of revolutionary strike that paralyzes the country, and that either leads to some sort of government crisis and the Theda have to leave, government's dissolved, a new one appointed, or even the end of the legislature itself and new elections somehow. I think that's what he wants. So I think from Madrid, the order is for a strike, and that seems pretty clear. But what happens in Asturias, of course, is not really a strike at all, even though it's often called a strike in the wider scholarship. So I think on the ground, it's quite ambiguous. I think when you look at the rhetoric of the committees themselves, there are clearly some very enthusiastic local militants who are in charge of writing these proclamations that talk about building a new society, they proclaim revolution, and they talk about banning money, and they do ban money in some areas. So they're really trying to change the kind of the social and economic fabric of the coal valleys themselves. At the same time, it's difficult, I think, as a historian looking back on it as well, in the sense that it's also an insurrection, and I will use the word civil war, or use the word term civil war, even though it's quite tendentious to use this in the context of the Second Republic, in the sense that what the Asturians are also doing, they're fighting government forces in the capital, Oviedo, and what they're trying to do, therefore, is wage a war effort, and therefore centralizing food distribution, giving out food with a voucher system to an extent is revolutionary, but it's also about waging a war effort. So it's not kind of clear through their practice what they're trying to do either. And it's also, if you go to particular examples, and there's a fascinating example in Labiana, high up in the coalfields as well, which is really interesting. And it shows how kind of paradoxical this particular movement was, I suppose, like any revolution. So they banned money. They tried to stop people using money. But at the same time, they organized, when I say they, I mean the Revolutionary Committee, they organized a collection for local shopkeepers to ensure they didn't go bust, and to ensure that they would have some money at the end of this. So there's a combination of kind of revolutionary ideals about how you put some kind of left-wing utopia into practice or call it into being in the present day. But at the same time, there's an attempt to kind of not destroy the foundations of local society. So on the one hand, you have a couple of miners who are potentially throwing their tools away and saying, right, that's it, you know, we've now reached the kind of the socialist utopia. And at the same time, the unions are trying to keep the blast furnaces warm so they don't cool and crack, and they're trying to keep the mines from filling with water because they know they will need to keep the economy going. So there's lots of different things, I think, going on for those first few days. I think there are genuine desires for revolution amongst some. I'm not sure whether the leaders really thought that a revolution was possible. There's a scene with one of the socialists, the veteran Asturian socialists, in which he's described as receiving prisoners that the militia patrols have made, and they've arrested local rightists, and they bring them before him in a sort of kind of for him to enact revolutionary judgment. And he basically frees them all. He's not convinced by this idea of a new revolutionary society with a new system of justice. But the militias are quite happy with this. They have gone through the motions of enacting revolutionary justice. So I think there are elements of revolution in there. I'm not sure kind of what, if it had lasted longer, what would have become of it. But certainly it's a paradoxical and a contradictory, multifaceted movement and moment.
Interesting. So as things were moving towards their conclusion, you mentioned there's a sort of a third wave of committees, and they negotiate a surrender, which seems pretty positive considering how some of these things end. How was that process like, and were those negotiations sort of honored on the other side of the termination of hostilities, I guess?
Yeah, it's a very strange thing to have happened, really. And I suppose it brings me back to the point of this being almost like a mini civil war. And I think we can think about it in two different contradictory ways to an extent. That on the one hand, civil wars are usually incredibly violent, and they don't usually end with a peaceful sort of truce. And therefore, it doesn't make it seem like a civil war. At the same time, this does seem like a war in the sense that you have the government forces recognizing almost the legitimate authority of the revolutionary authorities themselves, which seems pretty bizarre. But basically, I mean, what happens is the revolutionaries are on the back foot. After the first week, they've lost Oviedo. And a particularly important moment is when they gain and they seize the arms factory in Oviedo, but there aren't the arms that they expected that have already been moved. So it's pretty clear that they're going to struggle from there on in. Army reinforcements arrive, and so they get pushed back. So they're pushed out of the capital and they're pushed towards the coalfields. The advantage that they have is that these are steep-sided, narrow valleys that they know inside out, so they are incredibly defensible, and this is kind of the bargaining chip that the revolutionaries have. The reason that they wish to sue for some sort of surrender or some sort of agreement is mainly attributed to the reports of the violence by the armed forces on the population of Oviedo itself. So reports filter through of the actions of the army in places like the outskirts of Oviedo itself, where there is widespread looting, sexual violence, and the killing of civilians themselves. So this basically, this violence, almost to an extent, forces the hand of the revolutionaries to say, okay, you know, if we can reach some sort of agreement, maybe this won't happen in the coalfields themselves. And so one of the stipulations is that the colonial troops that form part of this column, that they won't enter as part of the vanguard, because they're perceived to be particularly violent. So basically, there is an aspect to this as well in which you have a bold revolutionary leader who is willing to cross the lines incognito in order to negotiate with the head of the armed forces. And I think the general, López Ochoa, who is relatively liberal compared with some of his subordinates, at least, and the other military leaders that he's working with, and compared with General Franco in Madrid, who's coordinating the operations, I think it seems that he admires the revolutionary leader for in fact doing that, and he agrees to a kind of a pacted surrender. So what this means is the armed forces will enter the coalfields on the 19th of October, so 2 weeks after the movement began. And the revolutionaries will leave behind the arms that they have been using. And in fact, what you see in Mieres, which is one of the towns, an important town in the coalfields, and which also seems quite slightly bizarre, is there a transitional authority was appointed. So the local revolutionary committee, in fact, hands over power to a former local kind of politician, notable. Prisoners are freed, and a lot of the revolutionaries kind of melt into the night, I suppose, and flee. But there is not; it doesn't descend into an orgy of violence at that moment in time. So the 19th of October, the army enters the coalfields. Many of the revolutionaries have fled. Several hundred do end up in exile over the coming weeks and months. But the occupation is much more violent and would be much more violent than that surrender would perhaps indicate. There is the looting and torching of the political and cultural centres of the left. There are episodes of extrajudicial killing, although these are more limited than during the military operations to end it itself. So more limited than during the taking of Oviedo. But over the coming weeks, there are mass roundups, there are beatings, there is a widespread use of torture in detention, most closely associated with someone called Lizardo Doval, nicknamed the Jackal. And the obsession with the armed forces in these arrests, in these beatings and torture, is where are the arms? So where have the revolutionaries left all of the arms? And where is the money? Because during the assault on Oviedo and just before the retreat, the revolutionaries have broken into a bank and broken into a vault and taken a large sum of money. So it was, where is this money? And thousands ended up in jail after this. And so, and then in addition to that, locally, there were also blanket dismissals from jobs. So all of the mine workers were sacked, all of the steel workers. There was an introduction of ID cards to allow workers to actually regain their job. There was a purge of teachers and the local administration. So it is both violent, but also completely kind of restructures the local labour market and also questions of sociability as well. Cultural centres are completely shut down or turned into sites of torture as well.
Okay, so what happens with the mines? Like, you know, the workers who work there were part of the unions and now they don't. Did they bring in other people or?
I think there is a certain... I'm not actually aware of inward migration to an extent. What you have, I think, are a number of workers who are able to at least navigate this context and regain their jobs. There is a case of a civil guardsman, so one of the policemen, who basically was, as the mine workers were filing up to the mine to basically ask for their jobs back, he would basically sit there and he would vet all of them individually, and he was basically looking for those who had attacked the civil guard post when he were, and the attack that he basically survived. So I think there were, as long as you weren't one of the leaders, then it was probably possible to slip through the cracks itself. And the fact that you do see some attempts at strikes, but quite difficult to organize in a situation in which trade unions and left-wing political parties are banned and there's no press either locally. Really in 1935, and they can't talk about strikes. There's no left-wing press that can talk about strikes. It's therefore, there is an organization, but it's underground, not very well articulated, but there are some strikes itself. So I think that indicates that, yes, mine workers could continue to work even though they've been members of the trade union. It's just it was very difficult to do so if you were one of the leaders itself. And of course, one of the things is that actually it takes a long time for production to be ramped up. So it's not as if it takes a long time for mines to actually reopen. And the same with the steelworks, even months after the insurrection, you don't see the same amount of production. So the same amount of mine workers was not needed.
Okay. So after the revolution was over, obviously, by that point, you're talking about 1935, during the occupation, we're very close to another large event in Spanish history. So were there any sort of lessons that were learned during this event that would alter the course of what people would do at the beginning of the Spanish Civil War? Was there like a legacy there of this revolution in Asturias that was considered during future events?
The relationship between of the insurrection to the Civil War is a very interesting question, and I think, and it's one that scholars really don't like to talk about a lot. And I think this is because if we fast forward to the end of the Spanish Civil War, basically, and the victorious or not quite yet victorious Francoists introduce a law called the Law of Political Responsibilities, which backdates, in many ways, the beginning of the Spanish Civil War. Retrospectively, support for the left, as well as fighting in the Asturian October or any kind of event from October 1934 to July 1936 is folded into the Civil War, and therefore this period becomes one of kind of revolutionary activity that justified the war itself. From a Francoist point of view. So it's very difficult at times. So historians have been very reticent to draw kind of any parallels between 1934 and 1936. At the same time, I think often the place of Asturias in the context of the Republic as a whole is underplayed, that we have this two-week insurrection, 1,500 die. It is massively important as a turning point in some respects for the Republic as a whole. And it's clearly it's crucial to the political events over the subsequent months. So the importance of amnesty, so an amnesty for the prisoners, for these thousands who've been thrown into jail for participating in the Asturian October. And so this is hugely, I think this is the most powerful motor behind the victory of the Popular Front in February 1936, but also for the right. The revolution gives or provides kind of material proof of the threat of revolution itself. And the memory of Red Asturias, the threat of Bolshevism on Spanish soil can be kind of invoked in over the course of the election campaign. And this idea of the army as central to law and order and as guardian of the patria, I think is it predates 1934, but I think it really becomes cemented by the insurrection itself. So I think the insurrection is important to kind of to political polarization on a kind of on a national level, and to providing the kind of the energy behind the election campaign in 1936, and also in to an extent in explaining kind of the results, the support for each side. But I think it also provides a lot of kind of the language, the political language and the political coordinates of that time as well, and also prefigures some of Francoism in that respect, in terms of what Francoist identity would be. Ironically, I think, one of the interesting things about the Asturian October is that despite it being a left-wing insurrection, what it does it is the end of left-wing insurrectionism in Spain to an extent. The anarchists distance themselves from using insurrectionary methods in spring 1936. The socialists have shelved it as well, despite their radical rhetoric. And I think in Asturias itself, in 1936, the Asturian October is critical to how left-wing militants see themselves and see one another. And ironically, this leads to a certain amount of crisis and fragmentation locally, because a lot of people do not live up to the revolutionary myth, understandably. A lot of people have been broken by the repression, or did not stand on the barricade at the right moment in time in 1934. And these people are denounced or boycotted, or have to prove their worth again in 1936. So locally, it's quite a fractious time. So certainly, there is an important legacy of the insurrection itself, and in terms of providing, I suppose, the experience of kind of revolutionary collaboration, revolutionary cooperation amongst the left, which would be seen during the Civil War itself.